April 8th is Buddha's birthday. And I always appreciate how when the calendar lines up and it happens to work out that we celebrate the day on the traditional day. So all over Japan, today, at this time, I don't know what time it is there now, but this day, people are celebrating Buddha's birthday. It's tomorrow already. Right now is tomorrow, Japan. This can only work in the realm of mind only. So, one last episode in the story of Buddha's birth. In the Lalita Vistara Sutra, the play of Buddha's life, the chapter called The Birth. O monks, the Buddha recounts, when 10 months had passed and the time of the birth of the Bodhisattva had drawn nigh, 32 precursory signs appeared at the palace. So the Buddha was apparently, Bodhisattva was in the womb for 10 months. Kind of overdue. The 32 signs included many flowers bursting into bloom and trees blossoming everywhere and sprouts appearing everywhere. From the slopes of the Himalayas, lion cubs found their way into the city of Kapilavastu, circled around the city, and then they came up to the doorways of all the houses without hurting any beings. Can you imagine? The city being taken over by lion cubs, like cute, furry little lion cubs. They just curled up on the steps of all the houses. The winds were quiet. The rivers stopped flowing. The sun and planets stood still. Everything got very silent and still. Through the power of the Bodhisattva, Queen Maya knew that the time for the birth of the Bodhisattva was at hand. In the first watch of the night, she searched out King Suddhodana and spoke the following. Lord, pray heed me as I tell you my thoughts. It's been a long time since I have thought of the pleasure garden of Lumbini down the road. I think there maybe it's like 50 or 60 miles, maybe less, from Kapilavastu. Lumbini is a separate town. It's been a long time since I've thought of that pleasure garden, but now I would like to go to the garden. If it would cause you no displeasure, no fear, embarrassment, or worry. Great king and husband, to spend your time in the pleasure garden of Lumbini. Hope it's not embarrassing for you, but we have a major event's going to happen here. Spring, the most beautiful of seasons, is for women a time to adorn themselves. The calls of cuckoos and peacocks resound in the midst of the woods, and pollen from many flowers flies everywhere, fresh and sparkling. Pray, give the order without delay. The king was pleased to hear these words. Joyfully he calls his retinue. Prepare the horses, elephants, and chariots. Prepare and decorate the Lumbini garden, the garden of most perfect beauty. In our quiet grove flower garden, during work period today, we can decorate the Lumbini grove to prepare for Buddha's birth with many flowers. So there was major parade from Kapilavastu, where they lived, to Lumbini. Prepare 20,000 elephants, dark blue and so on, covered them with gold netting and attached bells to the elephants. 20,000 horses white as snow, many troops of brave warriors. All these, we're going to like do a major birth thing in Lumbini. Drape the Lumbini garden with golden ornaments and pearls. Tie many red banners to the trees and strew flowers all about. Make all in readiness until Lumbini is like the garden of the gods. So everyone excitedly made ready for this grand procession to Lumbini and decorating the Lumbini Grove for the birth of the Bodhisattva. O monks, Mayadevi went forth from the gates of the palace, surrounded by 84,000 horse-drawn chariots and 84,000 palanquins, carried by elephants covered with ornaments of every kind. The whole garden of Lumbini, most beautiful of gardens, was sprinkled with scented water and filled with heavenly flowers. The gods had decorated it to perfection, just as they do heavenly gardens, and all its trees produced leaves and fruit, though out of season. Stepping forth from the most handsome of chariots, Mayadevi entered the Lumbini garden, surrounded by daughters of both humans and gods. Walking from grove to grove, she looked at one tree after another, until she came to the Plaksha tree, the most beautiful of them all. I had the fortune to walk through the Lumbini grove about a year and a half ago, and pouring rain, the end of the monsoon. Lumbini is actually in southern Nepal, right near the border of India. And it was very green. And the pathways, the beautiful paths that wind through this grove, were about 6 inches underwater. So it was like wading through this park. It looked like a pool. But the trees were very green, green grass everywhere. And Buddha's birthplace, where he landed on the earth, is marked by an excavated, shining green stone that you can look down at under the layers of earth that have built up over 2,500 years. And there's the pool where Mayadevi bathed after the birth in this grove. So she came to this Plaksha tree, the most beautiful of them all. Its well-proportioned branches were covered with bright leaves and buds and flowers, and it gave off the sweetest perfumes, the branches draped with streamers of many colors. As Mayadevi approached to the power of the glorious Bodhisattva, the Plaksha tree bowed to her in greeting. Mayadevi raised her right arm, shining like a lightning flash in the sky, and grasped a branch of the Plaksha tree to bear her weight. Stretching, she gazed at the broad expanse of the sky. Many goddesses and gods drew around to honor and guard her. Miraculous manifestations occurred, like those when the Bodhisattva had entered the womb. And now at the end of 10 months, the Bodhisattva now came forth, possessing full memory and knowledge. From the right side of his mother, he emerged. not emerging in the usual way. Some people, you know, even this in this cosmic Mahayana Sutra, this is the story, but even in the early Pali Canon, the Buddha emerged from the right side. So some historians think that maybe it was a cesarean section. At that very instant, Chakra, Lord of the Gods, and Brahma, Lord of the Saha world, stood before the Bodhisattva. Filled with profound reverence, they remembered and recognized him. Full of respect for the tender form of his body, they wrapped the Bodhisattva in a silken garment woven with gold and silver threads and took him in their arms. Then the devas of the Brahma realm took away this jeweled sanctum in which the Bodhisattva had dwelt while in the womb. It was like this, you know, stupa, jeweled stupa-like container that maybe only the gods saw, and they took it up to the heavens to worship this jeweled sanctum that was the Bodhisattva was inside while inside the womb. As soon as he was born, the Bodhisattva descended to the earth, and a great lotus arose from the depth of the earth to receive him. The Naga kings, and the Nagas are the, like, sea monsters, dragons. The Naga kings Nanda and Upananda, showing the upper half of their bodies in the expanse of the sky, caused two streams of cool and warm water to flow forth to bathe the Bodhisattva. So in our ceremony this afternoon, we'll enact that, and everybody gets to play the Naga kings, Nanda and Upananda, pouring the streams of water down upon the baby Buddha, ladling sweet amacha tea. Just like these celestial Naga kings to honor baby Buddha. Then Chakra, Brahma, the guardians of the world, and hundreds of thousands of devas sprinkled the Bodhisattva with perfumed waters and flower essences. Royal fans and jeweled parasols appeared in the air above the Bodhisattva, who stood on the great lotus, surveying the 10 directions with the gaze of a lion, with the gaze of a great being. O monks, the Bodhisattva looked forth with a divine eye which arose through the complete maturation of the root of previous virtue. With the unobstructed divine eye, he saw completely all the 3,000 great thousandfold world. All world systems with their cities and villages, their provinces, capitals, and kingdoms, as well as all the gods and humans. Remember from yesterday, he was offered this drop of nectar that had the essence of all these thousands of worlds. And maybe that was helped him to survey all of it at this point. He knew perfectly the thought and conduct of all beings, and knowing them, he saw there was no one comparable to himself, the Buddha, the Bodhisattva, in moral conduct, contemplation, knowledge, or virtue. The Bodhisattva saw no being equal to himself. Like a fearless lion, the Bodhisattva recalled the thought of goodness, which is free from longing, free from fear and terror. Knowing the thoughts and conduct of all beings, the Bodhisattva took 7 steps toward the east, unsupported by anyone, and said, "I will walk at the head of all the dharmas which have virtue as their root." Above him as he walked floated a great white parasol and royal fans. Beneath him, lotuses sprang up wherever he set foot. As soon as he was born, he took these 7 majestic steps. And in the new Zen Center newsletter that just came out, you can look at it out there, we have a little picture, an Indian painting of the baby Buddha walking these seven steps where the lotuses are springing up under his feet. In this story, he takes many sets of seven steps. Then he took seven steps to the south and said, I will be worthy of offerings of gods and humans. Taking seven steps to the west, he pronounced these words, I am the finest in the world, for this is my final birth. I shall put an end to birth, old age, sickness, and death. He took seven steps to the north and said, I will be unequaled among all beings. He took seven more steps, faced below, and said, I will destroy Mara and his army. I will extinguish the fires of hell with the rain of the great cloud of Dharma, filling beings in the hell realms with joy. Taking seven final steps, he faced upward and said, it is on high that I shall be visible to all beings. Just as these words were pronounced by the Bodhisattva, at that moment the 3,000 great thousands of worlds heard a voice saying, behold the essence of direct knowledge born of the complete maturation of the actions of Bodhisattvas. And many miraculous things happened when the Bodhisattva in his last existence comes to be born. All beings felt their skin shiver with pleasure. A great earthquake made their hair stand on end, and musical instruments of gods and humans sounded without being touched. All trees brought forth perfect flowers and fruits. From the heavens thunder was heard, and from the cloudless sky the gods caused light rain to fall. And on and on. As soon as the Bodhisattva was born, great pleasure filled all beings. All were delivered from greed, hate, and delusion, pride, sadness, depression, and fear. They were freed from attachment, jealousy, and greed, and ceased all actions contrary to virtue. The sick were cured. The hungry and thirsty were no longer oppressed by hunger and thirst. Those maddened by drink lost their obsession. The mad recovered their senses, the blind regained sight, the deaf once more could hear, the halt and lame obtained perfect limbs, the poor gained riches, and prisoners were delivered from their bonds. For beings in the Avicii hell and other hells, for beings reduced to the conditions of beasts devouring one another, and for hungry and thirsty beings in the realm of Yama, there was relief from suffering and misery. Amazing. All beings were freed from greed, hate, and delusion, and all their suffering at the time of the Buddha's birth. Just like we chant in the Jijiyu Zamai, when even for a moment you sit upright in samadhi, in the one-pointedness of mind and object, the whole phenomenal world becomes the Buddha's mudra. The entire sky turns into enlightenment. All beings in the lower realms, all realms, including the three lower realms, at once obtain pure body and mind. They all realize great emancipation and manifest the original face. This is just when you sit zazen. All these beings are miraculously freed. And then, as Dogen says later in that Jijiyu Zamai, the self-fulfilling samadhi celebration, he says, all this, however, does not appear within perception. It's unconstructedness and stillness. So after zazen, we think like, cool, there's nobody suffering anymore, right? It doesn't appear within perception. Well, maybe that's part of the thing too, is that we're talking about at the moment of samadhi. So to afterwards check out if anyone's suffering, You have to leave samadhi, you have to leave that one-pointedness of mind and object to observe the objects of suffering beings, and then they appear suffering again. But during the self-fulfilling samadhi, you can't really check out whether beings are suffering or not. In order to do that, you'd have to leave the self-fulfilling samadhi. The external world does not appear within perception at that time. So maybe the Buddha's birth was something like this. It was a samadhi realm, a one-pointed birth. And so we'll reenact this birth today. We'll celebrate it with a baby Buddha. We'll put on our own play of the Lalita Vistara. Then we have the Lankavatara Sutra, Buddha's descent into Sri Lanka after he was born, or appeared to be born, because the Buddha does not come and go. So we've been talking about words. We've been talking about words. With words, we are hearing stories in words. We're having many words run through our heads. We're wondering about the meaning of things and words. Mahamati, fools say things like, the meaning is like the words. Words and meaning are not separate. And how so? Because meaning has no substance. There is no meaning outside of words, but only what resides in words. Fools say things like this, that there's no meaning outside of words. Meaning is all about what words say. We might think that, too, huh? Like, meaning, if there's any meaning, it has to be in the realm of words and concepts. We have the teaching of the dual mirror samadhi, which is another name for the self-fulfilling samadhi. And in the dual mirror samadhi, Dongshan says, the meaning is not in the words. The meaning is not in the words. And that's what this section is about here. Section 76 of the Lankavatara Sutra. Mahamati, those in possession of such immature wisdom do not understand the essential nature of words. They do not understand that words arise and cease, while meaning does not arise or cease. What kind of meaning is this that doesn't arise or cease? Mahamati, all words are dependent on language. Meaning is not dependent on language, because it transcends existence and non-existence. It's not subject to arising, and it has no substance. Mahamati, the Tathagatas do not teach teachings dependent on language, because what exists or does not exist cannot be found in language, but only by those who do not depend on language. Are you getting suspicious of how he could be saying such a thing? The Tathagatas do not teach in language, he says. We have these little black squiggly marks on a white page. You've seen this kind of thing before. We usually call it words or language. Mahamati, if someone says what is taught by a Tathagata is dependent on language, they speak falsely. He said, the Dharma transcends language. Therefore, Mahamati, this is one of the famous lines of the Lankavatara Sutra. Therefore, Mahamati, neither I nor any Buddha or Bodhisattva speaks a single word or responds with a single word. And why not? Because the Dharma transcends language. It's not that we teach a meaningless meaning, but that words are the projections of beings. Still, Mahamati, if we did not say anything, our teaching would come to an end. So this is the other side. If we didn't say anything, our teaching would come to an end. Even though we actually don't speak a single word, we don't say anything. But if we didn't say anything, our teaching would come to an end. If our teaching came to an end, there would be no Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, Pratyeka Buddhas, or Shravakas. And if there were none, who would teach and who would listen? We wouldn't have Buddha Dharma. Therefore, Mahamati, Bodhisattvas are not attached to words, but expound the teaching of the sutras according to what is appropriate. Because the longings and afflictions of beings are not the same, I and other beings teach different teachings to beings with different levels of understanding, so they will get free of the mind, the will, and conceptual consciousness. Not so that they will attain the personal realization of Buddha knowledge. Did that sound surprising? I teach them in words so they become free from all these consciousnesses, like the eighth, the seventh, and the sixth consciousness. Not so they will attain the perfect realization of Buddha knowledge. So the Red Pine footnote is, the reasoning here is that such beings are still dependent on the way of instruction and not yet ready for the way of attainment. So even becoming free from these dualistic consciousnesses, I teach in words that, but the actual personal realization of Buddha knowledge, I'm not going to teach about that in words. Mahamati, to understand that nothing exists except as perception of one's own mind, and to transcend dualistic projections, Bodhisattvas rely on meaning and not on language. This is the constant refrain of the sutra, right, for those who've been hearing it throughout the last months. This understanding that nothing exists except as perception of one's own mind, and transcending dualistic projections. So that here is the personal realization of Buddha knowledge, and that can't be actually even taught in words. You have to rely on the meaning, not the words, to understand that nothing exists as perceptions of one's own mind. Right? So we've had all these classes with words, trying to reason and understand how it is that all the external world is merely projections of one's own mind. But in the end, to actually understand that, Bodhisattvas have to rely on the meaning of that and not on all the words about it. If a noble son or daughter relies on language, they will not only harm their own understanding of ultimate truth, they will not be able to awaken others. Once they understand characteristics and stages of different teachings and understand their expressions and their essential meaning, they will be able to use the bliss of true freedom from projections and their own delight therein to establish beings everywhere in the Mahayana, in the Great Vehicle. The delight and bliss of true freedom from projections. the self-enjoyment samadhi. To help everyone else enter the Mahayana. Mahamati, those who embrace the Mahayana, the great bodhisattva vehicle, they embrace Buddhas, bodhisattvas, pratyeka Buddhas, and shravakas. Those who embrace Buddhas, bodhisattvas, pratyeka Buddhas, and shravakas embrace all beings. Those who embrace all beings embrace the Dharma. Those who embrace the Dharma do not bring an end to the lineage of Buddhas. Those who do not bring an end to the lineage of Buddhas know how to enter the most exalted of abodes. And knowing how to enter the most exalted of abodes, bodhisattvas are able to constantly teach others and establish them in the Mahayana. Bodhicitta aspiration to carry all beings into the great bodhisattva vehicle can arise in a sentient being. Now we have another classic image that may appear for the first time in the Lankavatara Sutra, I'm not sure. Mahamati, if one person points to something with their finger and a foolish person looks at their finger, they won't know what they really mean. Probably heard that one before. It doesn't say the moon in this story. Sometimes we say it like a finger pointing at the moon. Maybe that was a Zen addition. But here we have pointing to the meaning. And foolish people looking at the finger that's pointing to the meaning and becoming attached to the finger of words. Foolish people become attached to the finger of words. Because they never look away from it, they're never able to discover the true meaning beyond the finger of words. Likewise, Mahamati, an infant should eat cooked rice, not uncooked rice. If someone feeds it uncooked rice, that person must either be mad or else not know how to prepare rice. Mahamati, the same is true of what neither arises nor ceases. Those who don't make an effort don't become skilled. Thus you should focus your efforts on becoming skilled and not on words, as if you were looking at someone's fingertip. Yeah, we have all these words. And the Buddha says if we don't teach on certain occasions with words, then the Dharma will just die out. So we have this Zen ancestor, and this Zen ancestor has us. His name is Changsha. No, with a CH. And one time he sat in the teaching hall and said, if I were to bring up the whole Zen teaching, there would be weeds 10 foot deep in the hall. Weeds is one of those Zen metaphors for all these, you know, extra growth that kind of like takes over. And clutters up the garden, the simple garden. What's that? Mind weeds, yeah. I think Suzuki Roshi says we can use the mind weeds as compost, right? We can use them as compost. And yet we can also forget to do that and we'll just get lost in the weeds. sometimes in Zen stories, they say, in the middle of a conversation, they'll say, is this a conversation in the weeds? So we could ask that now. Is this a weedy discussion? So Changsha said, if I were to bring up the whole Zen teaching, there would be weeds 10 foot deep in the Zendo here. So I can only tell you this, and we'll have, you know, a little bit of grass, but it won't be 10 feet deep because I'll keep it short. I can only tell you that the whole universe in 10 directions is the eye of a practitioner. The Buddha said to Mahamati, everything in this world is projections from one's own mind. Huangbo said, there's only this one mind outside of which nothing exists. Changsha said, I can only tell you that the whole universe in 10 directions is the eye of a practitioner. The whole universe in 10 directions is the whole body of a practitioner. The whole universe in 10 directions is the light of oneself. The whole universe in 10 directions is within one's own light. In the whole universe in 10 directions, there is no one who is not oneself. Before this light is emitted, there isn't even any news of Buddhas or Bodhisattvas. So where would you get mountains, rivers, and the earth from? Still, the grass is maybe 6 inches tall, going on 7. And the lawnmowers hanging on the wall. My time is drawing near to close. We can hear such teachings about mind projecting a world, but it's more and more words and grasses. So then Changsha, on another occasion, said, the person sitting at the top of the 100-foot pole, who's heard the Buddha teaching Mahamati over and over again. And through such teachings has ascended to the top of a 100-foot pole. Though such a person has gained entry into understanding such dharma, still this is not the truth. Atop the 100-foot pole, she must take a step forward. The whole universe in 10 directions is the whole body, Changsha said. You can find this in case 79 of the Book of Serenity, called Changsha Advancing a Step. So he recited that verse. The person sitting atop the 100-foot pole though he's gained entry, this is not yet truth. Atop the 100-foot pole, she should step forward. The universe in 10 directions is the whole body. And then a monk asked, atop the 100-foot pole, how can you step forward? And Changsha said, the Sierra Nevada and the Mississippi River, whatever mountains and rivers were around him in China. And the monk said, as you might if you were there at the time, I don't understand. And Changsha said, the whole land is under imperial sway. Or we might say, if it's, you know, how do you step forward? The whole Sierra Nevada, the Rockies, the Mississippi River, and the San Lorenzo River. Well, I don't understand. The whole land is under the president's authority. Obama gets to give the final word sometimes. So, who is this emperor, or this president, who has a complete authority over the whole land, do you think? The person on the pole. What is that person on the pole? Taking it in? Taking in the whole universe. Taking it into... Imagining the whole universe. Projecting the whole universe. Projecting the whole universe. And that person, like the emperor, that mind at the top of the pole, has complete authority over the Sierra Nevadas, the Rocky Mountains, the Mississippi River, the San Lorenzo River, little trickles of water, the water in the toilet, the clouds in the sky, the sun, moon, stars, baby Buddha, flowers on the trees, spiders in the Zendo. Top the 100-foot pole, one needs to just step forward beyond all the words that got us to the top of the pole. Step forward. The universe in 10 directions is the whole body. And the monk says, atop the 100-foot pole, but actually how? How can you step forward? Straight down. You can't fall out of it. You can't fall into it. You can't fall around it. Mountains, his response is, how can you step forward? The response is, the Rocky Mountains and the Mississippi River. I don't understand. The whole land is under imperial authority. Not really you, deciding to step forward. But when we say, when Huangbo says, we get to the brink and hesitate because fearing that nothing will stay our fall. But the Mississippi River is wide. The Rocky Mountains are high. The whole universe will stay our fall. But this is not in the realm of words and language. This is like fingers dipped in moonlight. Writing what for? Yes.
May I ask for a point of clarification on this one mind? Is this a universal mind? Is this Buddha mind? Is it what Patrick frequently refers to as interconnectedness?
We could say all those things. And they are not wrong, but the meaning is not in the words. And also Huangbo said about this one mind that is all Buddhas and all sentient beings. He said, that which appears before you is it. Sometimes the Mississippi River appears before you. And sometimes the Rocky Mountains. And then he said, begin to reason about it and you go astray. It also doesn't seem to be a matter of lobotomizing our projecting faculties. That would be no fun. But in the realm of projecting the Rocky Mountains and Mississippi rivers, how can we let them stay or fall? Yes.
Regarding words and meaning, it makes me think of usually the stuff that we read is written by a kind of practicing scholars, and there's a whole bunch of scholars at Stanford and Berkeley that are studying. Studying ancient texts, and it's a different way of doing it. Or the class that Catherine took up at UC here on the Lotus Sutra. I think the teacher was a practitioner, but the other grad students wrote that, and particularly practitioners of Buddhism. So. In the way that we're sitting and working with the projections, what we're saying, in the sense discord, what we sense
disturbance.
In the way that we're practicing with that.
Experientially, in our own body and mind. Mm-hmm. Oh, essential piece. Yeah. So integrating all of these, we could even see that all these teachings, studying these teachings, understanding the words, is like climbing a difficult climb to the top of a 100-foot pole. If we don't climb up there, the step off the top won't be as magnificent. The mountains of the Rockies and the river of the Mississippi, it might just be like a step from confusion into another moment of confusion, which is in one sense an equally worthy step too. But you know, there's something very just wonderful about studying teachings in words that kind of like help us climb up this pole of understanding, so that we have some more sense of the direction of practice. And then there's that leap, that final leap beyond our thoughts about what this practice is, what mind only is, what mind is, what others are, what non-duality is, stepping off the top of that pole. And then again and again, we climb and step and climb and step. Yes.
If we have to use words, perhaps poetry may provide a vehicle for the words to help us understand without the hindrance of logical mind.
Yeah.
You were using a lot of water imagery in a jet burner. Occurs now.
Yeah.
Snow is melting, and the village is flooded with children.
Yes.
And maybe flooded with children for the Hanamatsu celebration.
Yes, direct expression. Mm-hmm. Zen often comes in poems and images and strange stories. And maybe just to end here, we have the Shuso Dharma Inquiry Ceremony in a few days on Wednesday, where clear-eyed Chuck will sit on the Dharma seat and call forth the Dharma from all of us, for all of us. And we can all come forth and ask a question. And he will probably introduce the story of Bodhidharma and Emperor Wu. And one of our sweet Zen classic conversations in the weeds, where Bodhidharma came to Emperor Wu and said, and Emperor Wu said, to quote just a bit of it, because time's short, he said, who is this facing me? Who is this out there, over there, external to me, that can face me? What's going on here? He was a Dharma practitioner, Emperor Wu. what's happening here? Who is this other facing me? And Bodhidharma said, don't know. And we could hear that as, I don't know. Or we could hear it as the instruction to the emperor, I would advise you now to not know. Don't know. But can't we say that you are a parikalpita, projection of this emperor's mind, based on signs connected with words? Can we explain it like that? Well, maybe so, but actually, if you really want to want the answer to this question of who is it facing you, just don't know. Don't know that there's somebody over here. And the emperor followed the instructions diligently and proclaimed his great realization, personal realization of Buddha knowledge, and said, ah, I don't understand. And Bodhidharma, having done his work, crossed the Yangtze River, climbed up to that cave above Shaolin, and continued to demonstrate directly without words by just facing the wall for 9 years. And then there's a verse in the Book of Serenity that celebrates this, has a line, dropping the pitcher, he doesn't look back. He refers to an old story of somebody dropping a precious crystal pitcher, something like that, and it broke, and they just didn't look back, but just kept walking, didn't stop, say, oh, I missed it. So maybe we usually hear the emperor saying, I don't understand, is like, Bodhidharma tried, but the emperor didn't understand, he didn't get it, it was a missed attempt, dropping the pitcher and not looking back. But what if the emperor actually completely received Bodhidharma's mind transmission directly and completely? I don't understand, and never will, never have, never will. That's all. Still, Bodhidharma dropped something and didn't look back. The consolation. What's first place? And then after. Happy birthday. And happy birthday to all. And to all a good night. May all beings enter the personal realization of Buddha wisdom, not knowing, not understanding anything. And celebrate with falling flowers, Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.